this Kill Your Darlings Culture Club podcast. I'm Estelle Tang, the online editor. Today we are reading and dissecting Miguel de Cervantes' masterwork, Don Quixote, that behemoth of literature, sometimes called the greatest of all novels, and which features one of literature's most memorable characters, Don Quixote himself, a man both wise and mad. Tilting at windmills with me today are two very special guests. It's an editor's edition. We've got first welcome to Caro Cooper, who's an editor at Text Publishing. Hello, Caro.
Hi.
And welcome to Ronnie Scott, who's editor of The Lifted Brow. Hello, Ronnie.
Hi, Estelle.
Hi. Okay, so just to get started, Michael Wood, writing in the London Review of Books, said that Don Quixote is a book almost no one seems to have any intention of reading. People don't feel bad about ignoring it, they don't need to pretend they've read it, and they don't say they've always been meaning to take it to the beach. Caro, when I asked you to nominate a book to read, this was the one you picked. Can you tell me a bit about why you chose Don Quixote?
I think I have classics guilt, in that I just haven't read enough of them, and I've moved in with my partner who has just all the black penguins and they all have broken spines because he's read them so many times. So I think that's a large part of it, and also everyone at my work raves about it, so that was the other part, I guess.
Everyone at Text Publishing raves about Don Quixote.
Actually, everyone, as in Michael Haywood and Jane Novak, so that's, you know, everyone.
Yeah, that's, you know, pretty much. Quite a lot of people. Two people. Anyway, Ronnie, you've read it before, haven't you?
Yeah, I currently in my life experience no classics guilt whatsoever. If anything, I experience contemporary literature guilt. I don't feel like I give enough kind of current writers a chance as a reader. There's just something that I find horrifying about a new looking literary novel. I don't know if it'll be any good. But I had this horrible kind of classics guilt when I was an undergrad. And just because you have an awful lot of time on your hands kind of compared to when you're not at school. And I worked in a car park as well. So I could just, you know, really sit there and read all night. I sort of tackled things like Don Quixote and Tristram Shandy and Ulysses. And I think Don Quixote was definitely my favourite.
Yeah, for sure.
And I mean, is that what you maybe should judge it against, because they're all kind of similar sizes, or is that maybe the wrong criteria?
Yeah, it's like of the bricks of literature, which is your favourite?
Yep.
It is a bit of a weird one, like. And I'm interested that you read it kind of your own volition. Like, I'm reading it and Caro's reading it because, you know, we've said we're going to discuss it on X Stage. But just reading it, approaching such a massive book that is a classic on your own time, like, did you find it, did you have to assiduously keep going back to it,
or well,
did
you find it no problem? As I said, I was on the car park's time, really. Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
I could have sat there doing anything, I guess.
Yeah.
I think I did. I used to have sort of reading habits where I would have a few things going at once. And when you do that, there's obviously something that you would prefer to read, something that you can just rip through. And then that becomes a kind of its own reward system for reading the next 100 pages of Don Quixote, for example.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it's a wonderful feeling when you get to a bit of Don Quixote that you don't want to put down in favor of, you know, of some snappy crime novel.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's kind of nice to play them off each other.
There's a sense of achievement with the classics as well. I think maybe because I did a business degree, so I didn't have that, those years of uni where I was studying literature. And at uni, I was obsessed with books on war. So, I don't know. I think for me, there's a sense of achievement in finishing any classics because I'm just like, okay, I'm catching up and I'm enjoying it and it's not so bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. So let's very quickly kind of attempt to summarise the plot, which I don't know how well we're going to do that. So Don Quixote is a humble man from a small village who loves these chivalric novels, and they're just these tales of knights and adventures. And he one day decides to become a knight errant, and he enlists his neighbour, Sancho Panza, as his squire. And they basically just set off on a string of adventures, and including the famous one where he thinks windmills are giants and starts to fight them. So, I mean, yeah, can you really summarise the plot of a 950-page book?
There's so many subplots in it, and then the kind of novellas that pop up in the middle of it that are actually really enjoyable. It really, at the time, you're just like, how is this linking to anything? And then we're back with Don, and everything's fine again.
It's that lack of rules, I think, that you had back in 1605/1615.
They were wild back then.
Yeah,
oh, man.
They, well, I mean... you know, what we kind of currently think of as realism is just a set of conventions, right, that we've all kind of come to agree on over the last, 400 years or more. And I guess the rules just weren't quite as firmly in place back then. And so it makes perfect sense for him to digress and tell these bizarre stories that kind of mean nothing in the context of Don Quixote's story, but maybe mean everything in terms of the texture of the novel, right? And that's sort of one of the things that makes it so exciting now, is that it goes to those strange places.
And there's that whole meta, I hate saying that, but that whole meta element where he's referencing the narrator and then also referencing the man who wrote the sequel to Don Quixote and tearing that apart. And it's amazing in that sense for a book at that time.
Yeah, it's kind of supreme, like almost ridiculously layered, because so the conceit of the book, and I'm not even sure if I'm getting this right, is that it's Cervantes writes it, but from the point of view of either himself or somebody else, I'm not sure, who's found this novel, which has been translated by some person that has been originally written by another person in Arabic. And I can't...
Yes, yeah. But that's just like a throwaway reference, right?
Yeah.
I think it's...
Well, I think they kind of... He refers to it quite a lot, and he's quite purposeful in the way he tries to shore up this kind of fiction by saying, oh, and at this stage the translator decides not to translate the part of the original manuscript that says what happened here, so let's just scoot over that. It's very mind-blowing to think that he was just so inventive.
And also that he's playing off the whole Catholics versus Moorish thing, so he's like that liar, the Moor, and I mean, we couldn't get away with that now.
No.
Quite insanely racist.
Couldn't get away. Insanely racist. And very lots of stuff about women, too. Like, oh, women, they just can't make up their minds. It's like, well, I know I'm reading a book from the 1600s, but still, so I'm like, that's annoying. But it actually was published in two parts. So the first part came 10 years before the second part, and in the interim, somebody wrote a fake Don Quixote sequel. And in the second part, there's all these parts where Cervantes is basically like, well, this is wrong and this is made up. And it's really hilarious.
Yeah. And that guy was a liar, and he actually references him by name.
Right, yeah. So funny. And they've never found out who wrote that. There's some weird theories that Shakespeare wrote Don Quixote.
Because they were friends.
Buddies. They just used to sit in the studio in Brunswick holding hands and writing classics of literature.
And podcasting about previous great novels.
Totally. Obviously, there's no way to summarise this plot. But the other thing that that did strike me at the beginning was how violent it is. Like, some of the very early adventures that he sets up. Don Quixote sets off on are very violent. He just kind of goes and brandishes his sword at people and says, you know, I'm Don Quixote, and then they kind of just kick him in the ribs and like leave him basically to die. I was surprised that he was still alive after the first kind of three little journeys that he makes, because it's pretty nuts.
Yeah. Well, I completely didn't realise at the time, maybe I just ignored it, but that he's older. Like, he's an older gentleman for that time. I just kind of always imagined him as this crazy younger guy, you know, mid-20s or whatever. But then when you think about the fact that in that time he was a bit older as well, and he's getting kicked in the ribs and beaten by horses and whatever else they do to him.
Yeah.
And he's only got his cardboard helmet to protect him, or whatever it is, pasteboard.
It is very... I mean, it's weird because you're laughing, and then you stop and you realise, I'm laughing at a 50-year-old man being to death, while his squire kind of cowers in the background and just hangs around waiting for it all to end.
Yeah. And you can't help but think that as well, if this was if this were written today, which, you know, it obviously can't be, except that, well, you know, there's that Borges story, Pierre Menard, author of The Quixote, which is about a dude who sets out to write Don Quixote from the beginning, and exactly the same. And Borges is just constantly quoting, you know, a sentence from Don Quixote, and then saying, and here is the sentence in Pierre Menard's version, and it's the exact same sentence. And suddenly, like, the ideas are thrown into sharp relief because we're unfamiliar with the author and the text and the past 300 years. It's really interesting and strange. But that's, you know, just a Borges thing, I guess.
Yeah.
But no, if it was written today, I think it would be this kind of hard-edged neuro novel, because
yes.
you know, like a Jonathan Lethem kind of thing, or like that last Joshua Ferris book, where you're always, you know, questioning reality and what exactly is going on.
Well, the whole thing questions reality, like what's enchantment and what's not, and and craziness as well, like mental instability. Yep. The Dice Man, but in armor.
Well, that's one of the things. If it had been written today, I think that would be, the author would be much more forthcoming about the kind of illness that is affecting Don Quixote. But I mean, what's really interesting, well, what I liked about this book is that, you know, everyone he comes across says, you know, they marvel at his, he's also really intelligent. He's really eloquent. He has these whole kind of 3 or 4 or 5 page harangues that are quite elegant, and on different topics from marriage to chivalry or whatever. And everyone who meets him or encounters him says they were astounded at his intelligence, but just totally taken aback by his madness. And so they refer to his madness. Mm. But I think if it were written now, they'd be like, well, it was this kind. He was bipolar with, you know, just... Yep. And that would
psychotic
take away,
episodes.
Yep.
Yeah, and that would take away quite a lot of the character.
That's true. We sort of don't have any great mad characters anymore, like the type that you'd find in even, you know, Wuthering Heights or something. Just the general kind of, I won't swear, but bat something crazy sort of person who just shows up in the window or attacks
Sheen
a windmill.
Twitter.
Yeah, that's true. But in literature, it's kind of, you know, it's not enough. And it's sort of lovely to just have that wild card who's really brilliant and, you know, also just ridiculously out of it.
Yeah.
And also,
for an extended period and wandering
very
around the countryside.
950 page extended.
I also think that if we read it now, we'd probably be, as editors, we'd go, well, this is too unlikely. How can that really happen? I mean, let's look at the linear narrative here and look at the timeline, and this is all crisscrossing. They just didn't edit back then, and it was just so liberating. He just did things that don't make sense at all and just completely improbable.
Yeah.
And then he just makes them work. He's like, and that worked because I said it did, and that's fine.
Yeah.
And you kind of don't mind.
No.
It's, you just get taken along with it. It's a real page turner, I found. It's really, you think approaching this brick of a book, you would have trouble getting through it, but I found it really, really easy to read.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you do, and there's a lot of, Caro, as you say, that there's a lot of things that, you know, a modern day editor would just kind of go, well, you know, I think we've established that he's mad and intelligent, so we don't need these 300 pages. They're very similar, the things that happen to him. Like, he approaches someone, they think he's crazy, he does something weird, and then he gets beaten up, and then he goes on his way again. But there's also a lot of reliance on coincidence in this book. Like, all the stories are interrelated. It's like, this character from page 400 is the character on page 800's dad.
You have to keep kind of looking back, or I was googling them. I was like, where did that person come in? I don't even remember, that was 6 months ago that I read that part.
Yeah
There's loads of that.
Pretty great. I think we mentioned Sancho Panza before, but I want to come back to him, because he is, throughout the book, he's kind of hailed as this simpleton / chief of all men. He's a kind of, he loves food, he'll gobble up food when he comes across it, but he's also really loyal and very persuadable. So he kind of, at the beginning, he decides, I don't know, maybe my master's crazy, maybe I want to go home, but then someone offers him some money and he's like, oh, this is pretty rad. What did you guys make of Sancho?
He's really likable, and I have always tried to figure out who he reminds me of. But I don't mean in real life. I mean that there's some kind of stock character who you kind of see more often now I don't even know if it's sitcoms or what, but that sort of wily fool kind of thing. And it's in my head, for some reason, it's usually sort of a short, slightly bald guy, maybe Wallace Shawn or something.
Penfold from Danger Mouse.
I don't know who that is.
Right, okay. Generation gap.
I think I know what Danger Mouse is. But there's something that's incredibly powerful about this weird mix of character traits that makes him both incredibly likable and really frustrating, I think.
I agree. I think at the beginning you're kind of more on Don Quixote's, not side because they're together, but then as Sancho comes to realise how crazy his master is and starts to get, I don't know, I think in book 2 his character really develops a lot more. He goes from just being the kind of little chubby sidekick to being his own independent person and deciding whether he wants to be there or not and making independent choices and, you know, Kyoshi tells him he has to whip himself, what was it, like 3,000 times, and Sandro puts down his chubby little foot and says, I'm not going to do it, which I thought was great. But yeah, I thought he was a great character.
Yeah, he's interesting. I mean, he's the source of a lot of the comic, not relief, because the whole book, I think, is actually quite funny, but mm-hmm. he is really hilarious character in that, to begin with. So he's of a lower class than Don Quixote. I mean, I don't think Don Quixote's not really a don. He's not really a nobleman, but he's, I think he's landed and has a farm or, and a housekeeper and all of that. And Sancho, kind of comes along on this promise that Don Quixote will give him an insula, which is like an island. Don Quixote basically says, Sancho, if you come with me, you will become the governor of an island. And there's this hilarious, it's so funny, but in the second half of the book, this Duke and Duchess, who love these guys and think they're hilarious, kind of set up this elaborate practical joke whereby he becomes the governor of an island. It's not really an island, it's just a village, and all the people are kind of asked to go and pretend that he is. And he displays this kind of odd kind of peasant wisdom. He dispenses these kind of Solomon-like pronunciations on all these cases, and it's really the word that comes to mind is cute, because you just imagine this kind of tubby little governor going around. But it's very, it's interesting. He's definitely not a one-note character, I don't think.
No.
Yeah. No, he's good. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about the language of the book a little bit. There's been heaps of translations, but this one, that we read, well, I think that Kara and I read, is by Edith Grossman.
Mine is the, it's a fairly, John Rutherford.
Oh.
Hmm. Yeah. Yes. Translation copyright 2001.
Oh, okay. Mm. Well, I guess we can't really compare them because we haven't really done. But yeah, as I was saying, I found it a real, like, a page journal with very modern language. How did you guys find it?
Yeah, I found it the same. I didn't really stop to question anything. The one thing I did stop to question actually was they reference the Antipodes in it, and I'm like, wait, how can they know we exist? Wait, this was written way before us. And then someone told me that the Antipodes are just the outposts of an empire, and I was like, okay, I feel stupid now.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to share that publicly. But yeah, I thought the language was great, and like, I just found it interesting, the translation, because it was getting in the book translated from another translation, and it would have been a nightmare for Edith Grossman to do, but
yeah,
I thought it was great.
I remember being just incredibly surprised at how clean it was, sort of clean and simple, where you're sort of used to seeing Spanish sentences in translation that are quite elliptical and have lots of kind of, you know, dependent parts, long sentences that kind of circle back. And that's supposedly one of the big challenges of translating Spanish literature to English, because for them, just the way that their language sounds and their syntax and everything, it makes perfect sense to have these sentences that span, you know, 5 or 6 paragraphs. And so when that comes through in English, it's either a really kind of difficult balancing act to get right, or something that translators have to decide to kind of get rid of completely.
Mm.
And I wonder what the original language in Spanish was for Don Quixote, if that's different from contemporary Spanish literature, because this was really clean and there were very few long sentences. It was, quite simple and concise, I thought.
Yeah.
Even though the story is really messy and sprawling, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Well, I think there's a translator's note in the vintage edition, and Edith Grossman says she did think about this when translating it, because obviously it's a different kind of Spanish to modern Spanish. But then her rationale for translating the way that she did, which I think is very modern and clean as well, is that when Cervantes was writing, it was sparky and modern. His language was modern, and it resonated with an audience as modern. So that's the kind of tack she took as well. And she's left in quite a few historical details. So just things like, which I found really funny, like the measures of measurement units. So there's like this one called an arroba, which is like, it's a variable measure. So it's like, the arroba could be anywhere from 1.6 to 2.6 litres. I was like, that is so interesting and weird. And it's interesting from that point of view too, I think.
Mm. I don't envy her job though.
No.
It would be amazingly interesting, but such a huge book and so many details and so many notes throughout it as well. And
Yeah.
Yep. And it's the kind of book where if you translate it, it's not like you're just kind of publishing it into the public. You're publishing it into the hands of scholars and their opinions, probably very strong opinions if they've worked on Don Quixote for their whole lives or that, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we talked a little bit about these weird little breakout stories as well. So there's kind of a novella halfway through the first part of the story, and it's called The Man Who Was Recklessly Curious, and it's kind of just bizarre. It's just kind of slotted in there. He just goes, oh, we found these papers. Let's read it. It's a novel. And then it just goes into it, which is odd and funny, but... Yeah, I enjoyed it. Carrie, you mentioned that you thought it was quite cool.
Yeah, is that the one with the... See, this is how long the book is. Is it the Moorish woman that wants to become Christian, or is that the one in the second book?
I think that's the one in the second book. Okay. So the one I'm thinking of, but, I mean, they're basically the same.
Yeah.
It's just he kind of slots these weird little stories in.
Oh, the one with the man who's married and then...
Yes.
Yeah, I thought I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
I wanted to get certain of my friends to read it. I just think, like, it's... There's so many lessons in it as well without it being forceful, and it's still interesting and exciting. I don't know, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, so it's about a man and his friend who are best friends. They live together in the village, and then the man gets married and he suspects he wants to test his wife, basically the fidelity of his wife, which I just love. I love all this stuff. It's like there's this part in the second part of the book where they say highborn women don't have anything to do but fall in love. And you really get the sense that there's so many romances, and almost every single adventure is because I love this woman, she's married to someone else, I'm going to kill myself. But yeah, so this man wants to test the fidelity of his wife, so he asks his best friend to seduce her, and then he falls in love with her. I can't remember what happened.
He ends up wooing her, and then they're saying, oh, nothing will happen. He's reporting to his best friend saying, no, nothing's happening, she's really loyal to you, but they're actually having an affair.
Oh, yes.
And then she ends up stabbing herself, but only superficially, and
oh,
then
it's so good.
They run away and one dies, she joins a convent, and then she dies, and he ends up lonely and dies, the best friend. And
yeah,
it's a bodice ripper.
Yeah. It's amazing just thinking that, and it's real, like, insight into what cultural or stories that were like in the 1600s in Spain. And it's quite, like, Shakespeare was a contemporary of Cervantes, so it's quite similar to kind of the like the Shakespearean comedies where, like, the guy goes to war and then he, like, the woman pretends to be pregnant and, like, to lure him back.
It's all about tests and traps and people being a little bit sneaky with each other, but for very good reasons, because it's all about the heart.
Yes, that's true. That's very true. Okay, well, I love that I'm discussing this book with two editors, as we've discussed, because obviously it's very long, but it's also one of the first books that I think I've ever read that responds to criticism in the text itself.
Yeah.
So in the first book, there's this part where Sancho loses his donkey, someone steals his donkey, and then all of a sudden he's riding it again, and that was apparently much criticised in the 10 years between publication of the two parts. So in the second part of the book, it's amazing, and obviously he didn't have an editor to pick this up at the first printing, but he says, oh, well, that was obvious. That was just the translator or the printer just forgetting to put it in. What really happened was that the donkey came back.
And
yeah. Really hilarious.
And then they play another trick on him when they pretend to steal Dapple or whatever the donkey's name was, and then bring it back again, and it's like, oh, that's like last time, but the donkey's still here. I loved that. I thought it was really hilarious.
Really hilarious.
You can imagine all the editors sitting around going, ah, ha, ha.
We knew you wouldn't do us wrong, Cervantes. Yeah. It's cool. It's very cool.
Very funny. But also, I mean, there's just bits and bits, like, so much poetry in this book. Did you guys read the poems?
I have a bad habit. When I read Lord of the Rings as well, you know, you skip all the songs. You know, you give the first couple a go, and then you realise that they're not completely essential.
No.
Yeah, no, same.
Yeah.
It depends on the mood and how tired I am, but pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like they're necessary to the plot or anything, but there are quite a lot of actually quite funny poems at the beginning, I think, where they're kind of funeral poems for Don Quixote, or they're like his epitaphs or something, and it's all about, like, these fake poets saying how amazing Don Quixote was. And there's one to his donkey, and there's one to Sancho Panza, which I thought was quite funny. But yeah, the ones in the middle of the book that I kind of didn't really...
Did anyone else notice the I mean, he was the Knight of the Sad Face, but originally he was the Knight of the Sir Thigh Piece or something. And then what? He was also, there was, like, all the knights' names were hilarious, but I feel like Don Quixote's knight's name kept changing. Like, he was the Knight of the Sorrowful Face, the Knight of the Sorrowful Figure, Sir Thigh Piece. I know.
When's the Sir Thigh Piece?
Is at the end of which he decided to call himself Don Quixote. That is Sir Thigh Piece. I don't know. Like, in the Penguin edition, it's like page 28.
Oh, weird.
Yeah.
That is very odd.
There's just a lot of strange knights' names that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, so, I mean, as far as I remember, I know he definitely changes it once because, so he's called the Knight of the Sorrowful Face, and I think that's partly based on the fact because he was beaten up so much that he just looked pretty woeful. But then in the second part, he fights a lion, or he tries to fight a lion, and then he becomes the Knight of the Knight of the Lions or something, because there's this adventure where he goes to fight a lion. There's these people carrying this lion along as a present to the king, and he's like, just let the lion out, I'm going to fight it.
That's right.
And they go, no, it's for the king.
It's a lion.
And he goes, no, do it, I'm Don Quixote. And then they open the cage because they can't be bothered fighting with him anymore. And then the lion just stays in the cage. And by that, Don Quixote is basically assumes that he's won. Uh-huh. So then he renames himself. So I remember that, but I can't. There are a lot of inconsistencies in the book, obviously.
Yeah.
Like Sancho Panza's wife changes about 15 times.
Yeah.
Her name, sorry. It's Teresa Panza, and then it's something else.
Maria or something like that as well.
It's great. Yeah, it's very funny. But the second part of the book too is it's kind of even more metafictional even than the first part, because there is that sense that of him referring back to his own work and trying to rewrite almost what he'd made mistakes about. But also in the book itself, the characters have all heard of Don Quixote.
And read it, right? That's sort of the conceit.
And which so he's meeting people amazing. Who already know about him, and then they're talking about, oh, you've met the fakes, I'm the real one, and that's referencing the other guy's book. And
yeah.
It's really awesome.
It's super bizarre.
It's delightful, I think. Like, I think that it's the kind of thing, if someone tried to do it today, it would say something about the authority of the text or something like that, or it'd try to be sort of nihilistic in some sense. But I just love that it's playful and fun, and that that sort of mistake doesn't seem to matter in Don Quixote.
And also there wasn't over-analysis back then, you know. Yeah. Like now we've killed everything by over-analysing it, and you couldn't do that now because everyone would just be like, what's the deeper meaning? But back then they're just like, eh.
He just did it.
Yeah.
Just because he did it.
And there is a sense of, there's kind of an underlying sense of cruelty to it a little bit, because because all these people have heard of him, they, on the one hand, they act like he is a knight, so they welcome him into inns, and there's a duke and duchess, who we mentioned before, who kind of welcome him into their home, and they perform all these kind of welcoming gestures to him. So they offer to wash his beard and just really funny stuff like that. But then they kind of set up these jokes or these kind of so-called adventures where they say, oh, there's someone coming to fight us and you'd better, like they set him on a wooden horse one time and pretend that he's flying. And they're just watching him the whole time. Like he's obviously hasn't taken off from the ground. But he's saying to Sancho, oh, I can feel the sun on my face. And it's mean. Definitely got this really dark undertone to it.
Yeah.
It's really weird.
If you did that now, we'd be accused of picking on mental illness, which in a way it was. Like, they were mocking him because he was crazy and then laughing when he flew off the horse. You remember the wooden horse he flew off and landed in the bushes or whatever?
Yeah, they filled the wooden horse with fireworks and then set them off so that he would fall off.
Can I say one thing?
Yeah, absolutely.
I noticed when I was, because I was Googling stuff about it to just see what people were saying about the book, and I've noticed online that all the notes I could find and all the reviews referred only to book one. Like, not openly. They referred to the whole book, but all the points of reference were, like, the windmills, the sheep, and all the adventures in book one. And I bought the Penguin edition for my iPad just when I went interstate. And all the, you can see popular notes where people have marked the text, and they're all in book one as well. So it's like no one actually makes it to book two, which is, well, I guess they do, but they don't either enjoy it as much or they're not as, I don't know, awake when they're reading that part. It's kind of sad because book two is where it really, I don't know, it goes to a whole new level.
It's kind of mournful, right? Because it's sort of about or it becomes about whether or not chivalry is actually a good thing, and, you know, and what his actual psychological position is, and death, obviously.
Yeah.
It's kind of, yeah, it's a lot sadder.
That's surprising. That really, I mean, it doesn't surprise me, because it's a really, as it's really a long book. Yeah. I think I read that Jonathan Franzen hasn't finished it. Like he said, yeah. I've started to read it and I haven't gotten anywhere. But yeah, the second half of the book is so interesting. It just, but that is one thing I wanted to ask. I mean, the narrative pace, it's quite episodic. So there's short, really super short chapters. Mm. And I guess, as I said, I found it a page turner, but there are some bits where you kind of really making slugging. Yourself
yeah.
go through it.
I think it would be great if a newspaper, I mean, it would never happen, but a newspaper or a magazine now did republish it in serial form, because imagine if you just had it once a week or something and you could just relax on the weekend and read that part. You didn't see the 900 pages in front of you and have to lug it, you know, on the tram each day. I just think that would be a really great way. And also because I think as a book club book, you really do need to discuss it in short bursts.
Yeah.
Because there's just too much otherwise.
Yeah. I'm interested that you got the iPad edition, Caro, because one of the things that I did think, I mean, I don't have an e-reader or anything yet, but this is the one book where I was just like, I really need one.
Yeah.
Because it's so heavy. It's really hard to hold just physically. I don't think I've read a book this big before. Not even Lord of the Rings is this big, I don't think, because you can get Lord of the Rings now in quite compact, tiny little books. So,
yeah.
But it's really, yeah. And that is interesting too about the social networking side of it. Mm. So, were there other features with that edition, Caro?
With the one I bought? Not really, no. I mean, it was just pretty much, what are the book extras? It goes through the characters, important places. Yeah, I mean, it's got memorable quotes, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Books like this.
Ulysses.
Moby Dick, because that needs a good edit as well. Arabian Nights and War and Peace. He's a razor blade. Yeah. You know. The character and people thing helps, because you do get completely lost.
And can you click on character names as you read it and it takes you to the syntax?
No, but one of my favourite things about e-readers and the iPad in general is that with your Kindle reader you can highlight words and look them up, so a dictionary comes up. So if you know, even like words where it's referring to like an old type of horse or something, and I'm like, I don't even know what that is,
yeah.
And it comes up and tells me. So that's handy.
Exactly.
But I sort of feel the opposite thing of you guys, where I'm more likely to read short things on my phone, or, you know, I don't have a proper e-reader on my computer. And I'm certainly not against having an e-reader, and I would actually like one. But for something that's this big, like, I really love the fact that my copy of Don Quixote is the copy of Don Quixote that I read, and that I spent all of this time with this object. And that's kind of, you know, like where that time has gone into this thing that I have. So I think it's with sort of big cumbersome books that are the things that I would prefer to always read physically.
Yeah.
That's because you're big and muscly, though. I think the one thing that I get sad about with the e-reader is I don't have any of the marginalia that I would with a book I read. You know, with my other copy of Don Quixote that I started reading on, you know, there's bits where I've marked and gone, this is great. And you can mark things on this, but it's just not the same. And, you know, you can't scroll notes and tear the pages.
Yeah. Like, for sure. So, final comments. I feel really weird winding up a conversation on such an expansive book, but Ronnie?
Well, I guess the most interesting thing that I've always kind of liked about Don Quixote, which we didn't really talk about, is directly lifted from Milan Kundera, who said that he sort of traces the history of Europe through the history of the European novel. And specifically, what he finds interesting about Don Quixote is that the characters exist in this limitless Europe with a future that will never end. They come and go as they please. And that's sort of reflected in the style of the book as well, where obviously Cervantes kind of comes and goes as he pleases and does whatever he wants. And it's very much just this sense of expansiveness and mess, which sort of you can see just deplete throughout the legacy of Cervantes, kind of, you know, in all books since about, you know, when it was published, which I think is really interesting. And that's maybe something that I would like to see more of in contemporary publishing. Mandy Brett, the editor, who works for the same publishing house as you, Cara, yep. which I'm sure you know.
I'm really saying it for the listeners. Every day, yeah.
She was saying recently at the Mianjin Tournament of Books that the current trend for sort of short, snappy, concise, clean prose, which you mentioned, Estelle, as being a favorite thing of Anna Crean's. Sorry, a really elliptical way of introducing this idea.
I wrote that in an email. I didn't say it, just in case anyone's listening going, but she didn't say that. Mm.
This current trend for clean, clear prose is really just a trend, and there are lots of other ways that people can enjoy books, including very messy, sprawling kind of things. And at the moment, we're very much sort of focused away from that, which is, I think, part of why it's so surprising and wonderful when you read something like Don Quixote and it's pleasurable and fun and not nearly as difficult as you think that it will be. And maybe that is also because we associate it with things like Ulysses, which is famously difficult and where you do have to have Wikipedia open next to you while you read it. Don Quixote is not really like that, I don't think.
Mm.
So I think more people should read it. It's a hell of a lot of fun.
Yeah, totally. Caro?
I think Ronnie just got me thinking then. I would really like it if someone made this giant kind of wall chart of how Don Quixote, like, it's almost like a timeline, but all the characters, like the chart in the L Word, but like all the characters interacting and how they all meet. I mean, it would just be amazing because it is this ridiculous book, really. It's fun, it's ridiculous, needs a good edit, but no, it doesn't really. Just,
yeah.
You know, like, it would be fun to see if you could edit it on your weekend. maybe I'll do that today.
Cara Cooper, overachiever extraordinaire.
It's a great book. It's really fun.
That's actually something I'm going to go and look it up on the internet afterwards. I'm going to Google, because it seems like the kind of thing that's totally fitted for, you know, what are those things?
Infographics.
It could be the age of infographic. Or you know how the ABC Innovation website has these amazing kind of filters for new, like graphic filters for news, so like a traveling timeline or something. Like, it would be amazing if someone would do something like that.
Yeah, I would buy that and put it on my wall, I think. It'd just be a cool thing to have.
Absolutely. And I think, Ronnie, what you said before is true. It's really, I really enjoyed reading this book, and I'm glad that I had the opportunity to read it and encourage myself to finish it, because I think I'm quite a finisher generally, but it's big. It's really big. It took me maybe 3 weeks to read, but that was reading maybe 50 to 100 pages a day.
Yeah.
It's so big. But I really wanted to ask people to read it. I really wanted to exhort people to go and buy a copy of Don Quixote and just say, this is really hilarious, and you won't have read anything like this for a long time.
Yep, not since 1600, in fact.
You personally will not have read a book like this since you were negative 400 years old. And it was, very, very good. That's how I'm going to end this podcast, by saying good. Very good. Thank you so much to my guests, Ronnie Scott and Caro Cooper, and thank you for listening to this Kill Your Darlings podcast. For more information, you can visit www.killyourdarlingsjournal.com.